You're listening to Frame 25, a monthly micro edition of the Brightwall Darkroom podcast in conversation with and sponsored by our friends at Gallery. Every month we pick a title from Gallery's curated library and zoom in on a moment to better see the whole. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Today, let's just get right into it.
No time for small talk.
No.
Diving in.
Today, we are looking at a moment. This is inspired by Rinaldo Marcus Green's curated library. And it's a moment from John Singleton's 1991 film, Boys in the Hood, starring Cuba Gooding Jr. as Trey Stiles, Lawrence Fishburne as his father, Furious, and Ice Cube as the film's unlikely heartbeat, Doughboy.
Quite a movie.
You just said that you just rewatched the whole thing.
I did.
So let me get a general impression from you before I like skirt into the moment.
I thought it was even better than I remembered it being. I hadn't seen it probably since I was a teenager, so it's probably 5 years ago, you know, plus 20. And it was the first time that I'd seen it since I'd read more about some of like how it was made and John Singleton's career. So hearing that he was 22 just completely blew my mind when he, you know, to make a movie like that when you're 22 years old, you know, take that Orson Welles. Mm. It was great. Just the confidence of that and the whole thing. And it was just so much better, I don't know, better made than I remember it being. Or maybe it just felt more like, you know, further removed from the time period when it was happening. The coming of age stuff kind of stood out more to me. And so I really heard about like the fact that John Singleton's like most inspirational movie was Stand By Me. That really clicked into place watching it this time. Mm. I remember the childhood, boyhood kind of scenes being like 5 or 10 minutes, not, you know, 30 minutes or more. Then also just, I mean, like, it's not breaking news, but Lawrence Fishburne's performance and most of the performances, but especially his, was just so incredibly good. I just wanted to see a whole movie that just followed him, like just at his business job and stuff, or whatever he did, whatever he went off and did all day. I want to see him in the world because he was just wonderful. So yeah, I really loved it. I thought it was just absolutely holds up really, really well.
It must be interesting for you too, like if you haven't seen it since you were more in line with Trey and Doughboy,
yeah,
and like
exactly.
The coming of age style, to now be a father and be able to watch it and kind of key into the Furious character more must be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, of course, he was a young dad in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd had Trey at 17, I think it was. So he would only have been, even Cuba Gooding Jr. obviously is, there's some tweet I read that said, wow, Cuba Gooding Jr. aged 30 years in the 7 year interval. Because it really just all, he does not look like someone who is 7 years older than that little boy that he was. But yeah, so they don't look that, I wonder how far apart in age they actually were. But yeah, just, you know, seeing Cuba Gooding Jr. too, I mean, I've got later associations with him that aren't nearly as positive. It was nice to go back to the source and remember like, oh yeah, what a presence. Mm-hmm. And they all fit the archetypes of their characters so well. You know, it's whether that's just solidified in my mind over time or whether he just really kind of captured magic in a bottle there. And all the careers that movie launched, my goodness. It's hard to think of another movie where that many like debut performances of actors that would be around and in movies for, you know, the next 3 decades were all kind of started. So I don't know. What did you think? And also, stepping back, why did you pick this movie off the list?
Well, I love this movie. I have a real soft spot for coming of age films. And I think Boys in the Hood is one of my absolute favorite coming of age films.
Really?
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome.
I just think it's got a lot of vibrancy, a lot of immediacy. I think your comment that it's sort of like better made than it seems on first blush has a lot to do with the naturalism of the film. Mm. And I think it does take some sort of like intentional distancing of rewatching or returning to it to pick up on so much of the burgeoning craft in the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like the fact that Singleton was so young and that the screenplay, which he wrote, was drafted for his film school application is just totally wild.
Yeah.
And then selling it to Columbia Pictures upon graduation and making the film.
Insisting on directing it too.
Yeah, holds the record for youngest nominated best director, the Academy Awards.
Oh, wow. That makes sense.
2 years younger at 24 than Orson Welles was at 26 for Citizen Kane.
Nice.
So just a really like wild virtuosity at such a young age.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting too, because I think it's easy to think about something like Moonlight in 2017 and the Black Lives Matter movement and have a kind of ahistorical idea that this is a brand new, unprecedented moment for Black storytelling coming out of Hollywood, and for there to be some like extra pressure around diversifying who's telling whose stories for whom. Mm-hmm. But actually, there was this very parallel moment in the late 80s, early 90s, a moment of a lot of ambivalence, I would say,
okay.
with this rising interest in kind of multiculturalism, which I'm,
yes,
like for podcast listeners, I'm saying with a wry smile as if in scare quotes, because it's not something I'm necessarily like a proponent of as a buzzword for making money off of different kinds of stories. But
yeah.
at the same time, there's this rising tide of racist violence and xenophobia in the actual world, while Hollywood, white Hollywood, seems to be sort of clamoring for young Black talent.
Yeah.
So there's an amazing August 1991 New York Times Magazine cover featuring John Singleton alongside Mario Van Peebles, Matty Rich, Charles Lane, Ernest Dickerson. And the sort of headline of the magazine cover is "They've Gotta Have Us." And I think having that in mind, that this happened,
yeah.
and then sort of like, well, what came of it? You know, like what really came after the 1986 success of She's Gotta Have It? Spike Lee has had a really incredible career, but it's not like the needle moved that dramatically, which isn't to say that it's not worthwhile at all, but
sure.
You know, I just think it's really fascinating that these moments have come and gone before. And it's not to say that it's more productive to foster a kind of cynicism necessarily toward them, even though obviously it's a commercial industry, but I don't know, just to study the past and see the limits and opportunities afforded by mainstream success.
Yeah, that's very, very well put. Jeez.
Thanks.
My memories of it, man, I would have been in seventh grade or so when it came out. Obviously not allowed to see it. I think I've mentioned I was pretty protected from most things that weren't rated PG, so this one did not make the bill.
Yeah, steamy.
My wife has a, you know, a funny story about picking this as a movie to watch at her slumber party and her parents having no idea because it was culturally relevant, so they put it on. So that you know, but it was really adopted by white culture. In terms of, oh, this must be, I mean, seventh graders in a predominantly white town growing up, we were obsessed with, a lot of us couldn't go see these movies, but we had the soundtracks. So my memories of all these things is I have a tape of, you know, Boys in the Hood, of the Juice soundtrack, the New Jack City soundtrack. I have, you know, all these movies were coming out. So that's kind of, I would have to imagine what I thought they were like, you know, so. But it was also the same time that, you know, I was in Seattle and Nirvana and grunge were coming out. So just thinking about that year in the culture, 1991, you know, the year punk broke, I think, was the Sonic Youth documentary. I mean, it was just really a crazy year to think about being someone just coming into more of an appreciation on a slightly more adult level of the arts. And this was part of all that kind of milieu that was just a big part of. So it fits in with a lot of random things like hypercolor t-shirts and, you know, acid wash jeans and all these other things. This was that era. And this was just, you know, when I finally was able to see it at 17 or 18, it was only, man, 7 or 8 years after it came out. And so it was still that whole movement you just talked about, it kind of already come and gone. I'm trying to think, I'm sure there were more movies in that vein, but there was a real, the same way that when Pulp Fiction came out, everything wanted to be Pulp Fiction, you know, do the right thing kind of inspired this. And then Boys in the Hood, pretty high water mark. And then I don't think any other movie in that genre that I can think of came close to that standard. Even I saw Higher Learning, Singleton's follow up in the theater. And I remember just thinking, wow, I'm just learning some really important deep stuff. So 15 or whatever. But I don't think that movie is revered nearly as much or holds up. I haven't read it. Have you ever seen that one?
I haven't seen that one.
Okay. Yeah. It's a little bit more didactic is my memory of it.
Okay.
But at the time it seemed very deep and important. But yeah. And then to have Singleton gone, this is the first time I've watched one of his movies since he's passed. So there was a sadness because he's not that old or wasn't that old.
Yeah, fitting because Boys in the Hood is such a tragic film.
Yeah.
You know.
I'd forgotten what happened, so.
Yeah. Spoiler alert for listeners. Yeah, it gets real sad.
Yeah. I mean, but it's interesting the filmmaking clued you into something bad's going to happen to this guy.
Yeah, for sure.
But it was still just tragic.
So the moment that we want to talk about.
A very Veronica moment.
Yeah, is it? Well, I'll talk about it, and then I want you to immediately tell me why that.
I mean, a Veronica moment that I could actually spot from before you talk about it. I was like, wow. Oh, I can see some stuff here.
I can't wait to hear what that means.
Okay.
So I think this is a film where, no, like, earnestly, this is a film that has, I think, some really obvious kind of high-key set pieces.
Yes.
One of them being exactly, you had mentioned, like, the sort of surprising proportion of time devoted to when the characters are young versus when they become sort of teenagers, older teenagers. And there's a really great kind of sound bridge sequence that connects those two sort of sections of the movie. And that would be, I think, like a totally fine thing to talk about. But the moment I want to pinpoint comes from this first part of the film when Trey is still a child and he's living with Furious. But it shares something with that later moment, which is this kind of representative approach to sound on the part of the film as being uniquely expressive. It's something, it's kind of a subtle cue that really, for me, super enriches my viewing of the film when I sort of really pay attention to what's going on with the sound.
Okay.
So in this scene, basically, it's a home invasion scene where we open and are maybe a little bit confused about precisely what's going on. The editing is a little bit oblique. We're intercutting between increasingly slow motion footage of a faucet dripping, and Trey is waking to pee in the middle of the night, and Furious is hearing something, and then we kind of get shots of an invader like footstepping through the house, and the pacing kind of increases. The music, it's like this sort of electric saxophone solo, I believe.
Yes. It was about very 80s in a 1981 movie, but
It sounds like really dramatic, really suspenseful, and then ends with gunshots when Furious shoots at the intruder. And the camera kind of backs away from the shooting through the hole made in the front door by the bullets.
Like two sizable holes.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Really big.
Like rifled.
Yeah, Fishburne isn't messing around.
Right. And it's kind of a weird scene. There's a comic aspect insofar as Trey kind of pisses on himself when he like whips around from the toilet in surprise at the noise.
I didn't even catch that part.
Yeah, he kind of looks down and says shit. And I mean, he's a kid. Oh, and so that's kind of like surprising or funny or something. But what I like about it is I think like the faucet and that there's this insistent cutting between the faucet and the kind of actual action
that's
of the scene.
The part that I thought I was like, oh, the cutting here and the faucet.
Yeah, and like the faucet dripping, like I couldn't think of a more mundane sound than a faucet dripping. Putting these in such insistent juxtaposition in the scene just makes violence and intrusion and violation of one's supposed sanctuary by these forces outside that are unpredictable and uncontrollable, it makes that really mundane. And it says a lot about the kind of climate of violence in Crenshaw, where the film is set in 1984. That for me is the moment. It's sort of like it doesn't really like tie
cinematic,
up a loose end. You know, we don't hear about this invasion again. It's just sort of an emblematic event and does lead to some interesting scenes about like police interference and police presence in South Central LA.
Yeah, it introduces a lot plot-wise I know it wasn't his first night, but it was one of his first nights after he'd moved in with his dad with Furious.
Yeah.
That was happening too. Mm-hmm. So it was also just kind of a welcome to the neighborhood and what your new life's going to be like.
Exactly.
Kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Which, you know, it doesn't say too much about Angela Bassett's character, or I mean her house at the time. So it's hard to know what he came from, but this is clearly like an escalation of that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, while she's sending him there to learn how to be safer and be a man and all these other kind of things, she sends him into one of the most dangerous areas, like Ice Cube's character points out near the end. Like they show all this footage of stuff happening in foreign countries that are awful to people, but no one shows this. And so either they don't know or they don't show, which is such a great line. And it's true too. I mean, I was reading a profile with Singleton in Vanity Fair around 2016 or so. It was kind of one of those reuniting the cast for, I guess it would have been 25 years. And so they're just talking about how it got made and everything. And he just highlighted that he loved, you know, like 400 blows, and he loved all these other things. He's like, but you never saw that with black faces, and it just didn't happen. So he's like, I wanted, you know, so the inspiration for these movies were these really kind of classic coming of age ones. So he's like, I wanted to set that in the area where I grew up. He was a little bit removed himself, Singleton. He didn't grow up like that, he said, but these are all people that he knew, and these are all characters that he knew. And when you mentioned the slow motion thing, were you referring to, because obviously the more famous sound dropout and slow motion thing is the tragedy at the end.
Yeah.
Was that where you were referring to as kind of a foreshadowing? Because I didn't even notice that being in the faucet dripping scene, or the slow motion part. I noticed the sound design, but I didn't notice any slow motion. I just noticed the intercutting kind of ratcheting up. And then,
the drip starts to slow down.
Oh,
and I think it just raises a lot of questions. You know, when I've taught this film before, I've had students be like, what is going on right here? Like, I feel primed to expect that this has importance. And I think the importance of it, you know, as you point out, is kind of revealed much later by a much more extreme kind of plot event later in the film. But even this approach to the sound, I see later when the college recruiter Lewis Crump is visiting and talking to football player Ricky, we hear helicopters constantly like circling the neighborhood.
I noticed that in a bunch of scenes.
Yeah.
It's just kind of the backdrop, like.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Gunshots, helicopters. And so it just becomes this kind of atmosphere in the film sonically that is, yes, talked about and yes, seen, but also just so pervasive that we're always kind of hearing it as part of the kind of room tone that characterizes the film's environment.
I mean, even later in the film when she's studying and she hears gunshots.
Exactly.
And it's like, one, it's like, oh, this again, which is like in and of itself, just a very poignant commentary of like, yeah, this is what would interrupt, you know, your homework.
Right.
And then you'd have to worry about, obviously, is this somebody I know, all these kinds of things. So just as a cinematic moment, I'd say the faucet dripping scene and the editing there, high, high craft.
Definitely.
Again, for a 22-year-old with no AI, you know. Sorry, we are recording this.
We used to have nice things.
The AI discourse on Twitter, which will probably go on forever. But yes, it was so nice to see real organic filmmaking after watching some of the most insane, awful AI footage you've ever seen all day. Prior to, those are the two things I consumed media-wise were god-awful with wonderful commentary from people like Bilga, AI shots, and then this really beautiful organic filmmaking that absolutely came from the heart and just seismic impact on the culture. I just remember how big of a deal it was when it came out. Didn't even probably know what the Cannes Film Festival was at that point. But reading the marketing strategy, that's how they realized that, like, here's how we need to get this some good reviews so that it can roll out. So they took it to, and they all like left LA for the first time to go to like Nice and Paris and Cannes and all these places. And then this rapturous ovation and then Ebert's review that really just kind of kickstarted the whole thing. And it was a very, very big part of 1991 in my
1991, a good year.
1991, pro.
Thanks for listening to another installment of our bite-sized monthly series in conversation with and sponsored by our friends at Gallery. Gallery's been hosting a series of really terrific live chats with a kind of murderer's row of guests, critics, writers, etc. So you can keep your eyes peeled for more conversations that are hosted by us.
To join the conversation and see the rest of Ronaldo Marcus Green's list, you can sign up at join.gallery.com/BWDR.
Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Check.